If you have a Bible, go ahead and grab it. We're going to be looking at Daniel chapter 3, verses 8 through 30. We're coming to the end of our series through the book of Daniel. And what I shared with you at the beginning of this series is that there's so much beyond chapter 3, but for us to just take a chunk of that over the summer was important, not to go too deep so that we can really unpack that in the way that I desire to teach, which is expository. And so we would go more through the text than kind of do an overview or chunks, really get more at the text. And so we've spent 7 weeks in just these three chapters. And so let me just give you a little setup for where we're at. Because last week, what we looked at in the first part of chapter 3 was that Nebuchadnezzar, King Nebuchadnezzar, had brought up a statue that was really driven and inspired by the dream that Daniel had interpreted for him. And this golden statue was 90 feet tall by 9 feet wide. So this image would have stood up and stood out around for everything from miles to sea. And the average statue, just to give you some perspective, in that day was around 12 to 18 feet tall. So the average one was about 12 to 18 feet tall. And here you have one that's 90 feet tall. It's a little bit of a difference. And so this thing was massive. And so now we come both to the end of chapter 3 and the end of our series. And what we see is the idolatry of a pagan king as he worships himself through this image. But yet we see the true and unwavering worship of faithful young men to the true God. And so in this part of chapter 3 in the book of Daniel, a shift is really taking place that we're going to see. Because this part of the story isn't about Daniel. It doesn't talk about Daniel in this text. We've seen a lot go on with Daniel, but here it's about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and their character in the midst of a trial and God's response and rescue to them and for them. And so we're going to read in Daniel chapter 3, starting in verse 8. Therefore, at the time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire? They answered and said to the king, True, O king. And he answered and said, But I see 4 men unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire he had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. And Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruins. For there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So really, in this text, up to this point, we haven't heard much about these three young men. But these men really have proven themselves to be both faithful and wise. And if we really do a brief overview of the last three chapters that we've really studied, then there's much that's revealed about their character and their faithfulness to God. And so really, if we look, starting in chapter one, the first time we hear about these young men was in verse 7, when their names were changed along with Daniel, when they were brought into Babylon through captivity. And what I said was, although it isn't obvious from the English text, all the name changes in verse 7 had special meaning. It had special meaning for both them and for the Babylonian rulers, because the Hebrew names all contained references to the God of Israel, but the new Babylonian names mentioned the gods of Babylon. And so I shared this with you before, that Hananiah means the Lord is gracious. He became Shadrach, which means command of Aku, the Sumerian sun god. And then there was Mishael, whose name means who is like the Lord, and that became Meshach, which means who is what Aku is. And then Azariah, which means the Lord is my helper, became Abednego, and that means servant of Nebo, another Babylonian god. And then we see in chapter 1 later that they are set apart. They choose to be set apart from all their other peers that are brought into Babylon. And so they ate things differently. They drank things different. They didn't consume what the culture around them was consuming. So they were set apart. And then in chapter 2, we hear again about these young men in verse 17 and 18. And these verses really reveal their character and their faithfulness to God. We see this in verses 17 and 18 when it says, Then Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery. This mystery was the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, and so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So here you have Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah all seeking the Lord first in chapter 2 in this text in the midst of a trial. And so now as we come to chapter 3, they're facing their own trial. We don't see Daniel in the midst of this picture, but these three young men are facing their own trial. And really what's happening here is, remember, they had been promoted over the affairs of Babylon. That's made clear in verse 12. And then if they didn't bow down, some things would happen. They would lose not only their position, but they would also lose their lives. But they understood that to bow to the king's statue would be for them to compromise on their convictions. And so really, for many who were bowing down, they would have thought, man, all you needed to do was conform outwardly. Inwardly, you can worship your God. Just conform outwardly so it doesn't kill you. And so this is just one of many gods, was the culture's thinking. And we talked about this last week, the difference between how we view God as the one true God, which is really that worship to God is singular. There's no other God, which we would call monotheism. And really the worship of the culture going on is everybody can worship their own God in their own way of however that works for them. Really the plural is okay. And so there's polytheism. And so this was a pluralistic culture that they were in, believing that there were many gods and many ways to salvation and to the divine. And so the question really for everyone else was, man, well, what's wrong if I just bow down to this one God? What's wrong if you bow down? There's many other gods. It's just one of many. But that would have meant disobedience to the one true God. And so these young men don't waver in their conviction. And so here they've been accused and tried, and now they're in the midst of persecution and facing death. And so what we're going to see from this text, from these three young men, is as they stand before this pagan king, they remain faithful to God. They remain faithful to God, where we see in this that God is able to deliver us in trials, but regardless of rescue, we need to trust in him. And so if you're taking notes, those are your fill-ins for this morning. That God is able to deliver us in trials, but regardless of rescue, we need to trust in him. In verses 16 through 18, these are amazing verses, because here we see both the boldness of these young men and their trust in God. That in verse 16 and 17, they give a very bold and blunt answer. They're not trying to appease the king. They're being very honest with him, and they're clearly stating, here's where our loyalty lies. They say, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. So here we see in the midst of conflict and the trial, these young men remain faithful. That regardless of what the king could do to them, they are clear. It is God alone whom we serve. And so we learn a few things from them in this text. That first, we need to have a right view of our trials. We need to have a right view, because often people ask the question, man, why do bad things happen to good people? But what we see in Scripture is that one of the things that followers of Christ begin to learn is to ask a different question. In the midst of trials, to have a right view of those trials, they begin to ask, God, how are you at work in my mess? And how do you want to use it for your message? How are you at work in my mess? And how do you want to use it for your message? See, oftentimes it's difficult for us to see down the road ahead of the issue. For us, all we can see is today. Scripture's clear on this. We can try to make plans. We can try to have everything calendared out. That's not the way to say it, but we'll go with it. But basically, you can make plans for tomorrow, but all you can see is today. And sometimes when we're in the midst of those trials, all we see is the brokenness and the struggle of that trial. So especially when we're in the midst of it, we struggle to see anything else but that. But what we see and learn through Scripture is that trials are a part of following Jesus. So the reality is, following Jesus is not the easiest decision you will ever make. It's the best decision you will ever make, where he is at work in our lives in the midst of our trials, even when we don't see the outcome. We see this in the gospel when Jesus comes as the Messiah. John the Baptist is in prison, and he sends news asking, are you who we've been waiting for? In the midst of this trial, in the midst of me being in prison, are you who I've been waiting for? And we see this in Matthew 11, verse 2 through 5. It says, now when John heard in prison about the deeds of the Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another? And Jesus answered them, go and tell John what you have heard and see. The blind receive their sight and the lame walk. Lepers are cleansed and the deaf hear. And the dead are raised up and the poor have good news preached to them. Now here's what's interesting. Those are not Jesus' own words in physical form. Jesus is quoting the prophet Isaiah from Isaiah 53 and 61, but he leaves out the part about the captives going free. Now, John would have known this text. He would have been well aware. I would imagine in some way almost waiting like, and the captives go free, and they don't communicate that part. And so then John dies in prison. He's beheaded, and Jesus comes. And then the long-awaited Messiah brings forth the truth of the gospel. So here's what this tells us as John is wondering, man, are you who is to come? And he's looking for an answer. What he was doing was looking to Jesus. So in the midst of our trials, we need to not look for all of the answers. We need to look to Jesus, that he is at work in the midst of all of it. And our joy comes from knowing that he is using it. He's using our trials for his glory, that he would grow us in and through them. And so when one is in relationship with God for what they can get, really ask, why are you letting this happen to me? Why would you let me walk through this trial? Why would you allow me to walk through this difficulty? For us, when we put our faith and our trust in God, our question really becomes, God, how can I glorify you in and through this? How can this mess of mine become part of your message? So this question really shifts our focus. So now it means that we need to have a right focus in our trials. Because the issue is that if we're not at a point of being prepared for trials, because they will come, then they're not only going to surprise us, they may even overcome us. So we need to be prepared and we need to be ready. And I've shared this with you before. When we walk through trials, it's much like being in a fight. That because if you know you're going to be in a fight or a conflict, then your stance is going to be intentional. If you see someone ready to be in a fight, their stance is at defense. It's prepared and it's ready. And so for us, we need to have a right focus in our trials. Because the person who walks around, woe is me, look what would happen to me, look at how bad my life is, that person hasn't put their trust in God. The person who has a stance ready saying, God, what do you want to do in this? That it would produce joy. Oh, how ludicrous to the world that would feel. But how glorious God's grace is in the midst of that, that we can put our faith in him, our trust in him, going, God, I don't see any of what you see, but I trust you. That is where we're prepared and ready. But really, we need to be prepared and ready regardless of rescue. In verse 18, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah conclude their response with an unwavering stance to the king. In verse 18, my favorite three words in this text, but if not, if God does not save us, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. And so regardless of rescue by the God whom they served, they were committed to remain faithful. These young men were committed. That in the text, there's this constant repetitiveness of regardless of what happens for us, regardless of how great things go or how awful things go, we will trust in you alone, God. And see, further in this text, there's a constant repetitiveness, a repetition of names and lists of people and themes going on in the midst of this. And this is intentional by the author. What this tells us is that the pressures to conform to this world is a constant, unrelenting drumbeat. And really one that when resisted, when we try to resist that, it doesn't stop. It doesn't ease up. It just goes louder and more persistent. That's what it's like in the world for us to try and conform to it. It's like a drumbeat. It's louder and more consistent. And there's times where we're going, man, drums seem appealing, but have you ever heard a loud tom drum in your ear? Just louder and louder. That's not going to ease up. Our culture is going to try and push in more, conform to us, conform to this. And so really we need to ask ourselves some questions. What is it we hear most right now? Is our ear turned to the beat of that drum, or is it tuned to God? What's the world calling us to bow down to? What's the word or the song or the issue we keep hearing, beating in our own heads right now that's trying to drive us to pursue that, to serve that, to worship that? Let me ask you this, what's your motivation? What motivates you? What are you bowing down to? What are you willing to give yourself and your affections over to? See, in this case, the king has set up a false image, and he was intent on having everyone else bow down to his image, that everyone would worship him. And really, everything was fine until he encountered those who would not bow down to him or celebrate with him. And so really, when he was not completely affirmed in his own view of the world and himself, he responded with outrage. How dare you not see me as great as I see me? And so really, we're really living in this kind of world full of little Nebuchadnezzars, each where they're really demanding everyone bow to the images they've created themselves, and all while denying what is truth. And so really, because we deeply desire to be loved and accepted in this world, we comply rather than suffer being labeled as an outsider. We really try to almost keep the peace, like make sure that we don't upset that person. And this is almost a language, unfortunately, that kind of trickles into our churches, that we have to be so sensitive that we take apart the pieces that may look like we radically serve Jesus, that we've traded almost that reverence for Christ for that reverence, that relevance to culture. And so now the spotlight is really on these three young men. So they either need to bow down or they will burn. And so there's a turning point here. And really for us, I believe that when we're confronted with the pressure of our culture, we tend to do one of two things. That one, we tend to tell ourselves where the bowing line is. That we consider it so far from where we are now that when it comes to something that really matters, that then we'll stand up, then we'll stand out, willing to suffer the consequences based on principle. But until then, we just more tend to tell ourselves, if I'm quiet, then I'll have a greater impact for the truth later. If I just stay quiet, if I don't ruffle the feathers of what's going on, it'll be better later. And then we easily bow down to every song that the world plays, not even realizing we're doing it. Or another thing that we tend to do under the pressure of culture is we tend to assume everything is a bowing line. And we boldly declare our lack of approval towards any change or anything we don't like. And we're so vocal and combative that there's a big issue. So our opposition is unnoticed because we don't approve of anything. That we're not speaking and moving and leading out of our convictions, but out of our preferences. I don't agree with you, you're wrong. But remember what we've talked about before is that the Christian is not called to tell the culture what they need to do. They need to demonstrate what a Christian is called to do. And so these two examples right here, the first is unfaithful and the second is ineffective. And so taking a stand and being apart from the culture is about trusting in God, not in our own method. And this is really what we see from these young men. We see that towards the end of our text, in verse 23, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are bound up, and they're thrown into a fiery furnace. And in this moment, if you just stop there, all hope seems lost. It seems that God has just left them there. But we truly worship a God who is able. And really, this is good, but this is easy to say. It's almost like saying, man, I'm a Seahawks fan. I'm on the team that's going to win today. I'm on the team. We're going to win. We've got this. But these men really go a step further. This is what they truly say that sets them apart. But if not, if we don't succeed, if in the midst our God does not save us, we will trust in him alone. See, their resolution is not conditional on if God saves them. They confidently resist knowing he is able to deliver them. And they really rested in submission to God. So regardless of if he saved them or not, they truly trusted in him alone. So it's not the quantity or even the quality of their faith, it's the object of it. That they resolved to trust God, the creator. That they would not bow to the gods that man had created. And truly, they knew the image wasn't really anything. They knew it was just an idol that was powerless. And so even their focus there in the midst of the trial is fixed on the one true God. So they displayed where their hope is, that it was to God alone. So this for them really meant that he was first, that he cannot and will not be second in their lives. And then in verse 23, we see an incredible and important detail of these young men being thrown into the furnace. See, often when we read the Bible in the English text, we miss a lot of the context. So really that word, if you go back and you look in Hebrew, the Hebrew word for fell or fall is not like they tripped. That word, that root word, is actually the same that's referenced earlier in verse 6 to describe an act of worship. So what this means is that as Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah fell down, it was in worship. It wasn't in fear or in pity. As they fall into the furnace, they fall before God, that he was with them even to the point of death. And so in verses 24 through 25, it really reveals that the king sees more than the three young men in the furnace. He now sees four men. He sees four men that are standing there with what? They're unbound and they're walking around free. See, often we look at our trials as the thing or the things that make us weak in life and in faith. But the reality is that when we trust in God, through him, we are stronger than we could ever be, because it's not dependent upon our strength. So really, everything else becomes secondary. The reality, even as Paul wrote to the church in Philippi, to die is gain, to live is Christ, but to die is gain. Man, it'd be so much better if I was just to die and go home to be with Jesus. What do you do with a guy like that? Paul's one of my favorite in the New Testament, because they flog him and they beat him, and he's like, under the glory of God. They're like, oh, let's shut him up and throw him in jail. And he's like, oh, a week later, the jail's converted. They're all Christians now. That's a little church. They're like, man, what do we do with this guy? Let's just kill him. That'll work. Man, thank you. Send me home to my father. And they're like, oh, man, what do you do? That kind of faith is unstoppable. And every step for Paul, for these three young men, for Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, it wasn't their own strength. It was God's strength in them. So really, the king could kill them, but nothing would matter. There's a pastor in Romania who was persecuted, and one of the things he said in the midst of his persecution was, he said, your supreme weapon is killing. My supreme weapon is dying. See, there's a different perspective for someone who puts their trust completely in Christ. And so really, church, that's our need. This is what we learn from this text and from these young men. So just to encourage you, as we move closer and closer to Christ's return, the furnace of opposition in our culture will become hotter. And the pressure to conform will become stronger. That's just the reality. And it will take a great deal for us of grace and prayer and courage and faith in Christ for us to stand for him while others are bowing to the gods of this world. And so remember, what we learn from Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah is that they stood strong and they didn't conform to the standards of this world. Their trust was in God, that regardless of rescue from the furnace, they put their trust in him. That ultimately, their desire was to serve God alone and to trust in him alone. And so as we come to a close and we return to a time of worship, let me ask you this question. Let me have you ask yourself this question. What are you trusting in? In the midst of opposition, in the midst of difficulty, what are you trusting in?